So I feel, you know, if we're gonna like, you know, make this world a better place, the universe, that, you know, that we need to all, like, you know, all these four elements, they all work together. When we talk about sustainability, like, you know, all these four elements work together to keep us alive. They sustain us.
I think what Levi says echoes directly the answer I feel to your question about in the best of all possible worlds, how would environmental decisions be made? I don't think they would be political footballs at all. I think the environmentalism, that ethos, would be completely internalized. And nobody would do anything until they understood the environmental implications of it and had done some soul searching as to whether they really need to, you know, take this tree or rip up this piece of land and plant a garden. And there are legitimate needs that are worth pursuing and, you know, defensible even in an environmental context. And I also think that nobody would make a decision because every environmental issue is grounded in place. There's always an environment somewhere that is being disturbed. Nobody would make a decision about that place without knowing it well, without having been there. So the CEO of Interfor, as you were referring to, Beth, comes to the place where he's about to sign off on the order to clear cut. And, you know, before anything is done, he looks at it and he knows it. He gets to know it. Mm-hmm. And talks with people who live there and whatnot, rather than, you know, from his office in, it's easy to make any kind of decision from an office in high-rise in New York City or wherever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no wonder we're having environmental issues if that's where you're making your decisions from.
Yeah, one of the things I admire most about our First Nations neighbors here is their concept of ownership, hopefully. As I understand it, it's to have hopefully is to have responsibilities to the land and to the people, to provide for the people from the land, but also responsibilities to the land itself. That's part of hopefully. When you have that responsibility, that ownership, you also own other things. You own the responsibility to the land and the responsibility to the people. And from this perspective, I find our concept of private ownership to be greatly impoverished, because it provides people with a almost an antediluvian tyranny over the land, dominion over the land. You have no responsibilities to anyone.
Yeah.
Aside from perhaps to pay property tax when you own land. You don't have any responsibilities to the trees. There are perhaps some regulations that might apply with respect to riparian areas or threatened or endangered species, but that's about it. There aren't really positive obligations. And I think one of the ways that we could move in embedding an environmental ethic into our economic activities would be to put it into the concept of property.
I think an interesting contrast between the notion of a hoopley and corporation is that a corporate CEO his legal responsibility is to the stockholders, to the owners of the corporation, have no responsibility to government, to community, and to environment. They are legally beholden to act only on behalf of the financial interests of the stockholders. They can go to jail if they act otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that really is what I think drives so many of
them. But they're not legally responsible to act illegally or immorally.
Immorally, I'd say that yes, they are many times.
There's some gray area there.
Illegally, they have, you know, teams of lawyers to figure out how to navigate that edge. And I think McMillan Woodell was a great example of a corporation that you know, successfully, you know, when in and out, like, you know, trespass as much as you can.
That should tell you that the real problem is not the corporations, but us and the government. If the government could pass a stupid law saying you can't cut down any tree over 30 centimeters in diameter, and it's simply easy to monitor. You go find a tree that's over 30 centimeters, you charge them $400,000, and they would stop doing it. Mm-hmm. But they don't. They don't. The corporations behave in accordance with the rules laid down.
But they're often involved in making the rules.
Yeah, and they're pushing the edge of the rules, it's happening.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a step back here, because I've been reflecting on both on this conversation and some things that Derek said earlier about virtue ethics, and, which I agreed with initially, and then the more I think that virtue ethics is a problem. And I began to think about how your corporate CEO thinks of himself as an extraordinarily virtuous person, more virtuous than anybody else in this room. Why? Because he probably works 90 hours a week, makes enormous sacrifices, does not do what he wants to do. He doesn't get around and sit around in a group like this and philosophize and hang out and enjoy life. He thinks that he's making enormous sacrifices, and people like us are far less virtuous than he is by virtue of the way that he has constituted himself as this, as it were, a warrior in the world. Creating things, making the world go round in accordance with the rules that have already been established. I was also thinking about why is it that many people detest environmentalists? And that's because they see environmentalists as holier than thou. And they're the ones who are always throwing it in your face and saying, look how wonderful I am. You're doing this, I'm doing this. Aren't it good? So it seems to me that part of the politics in which one has to engage is, how shall I put it, disrupting these claims to virtue. That if environmentalists put themselves forward as those who are more virtuous, that's not going to get anywhere, because you're soon up against these people who think for some reason that they're far more virtuous than any environmentalist because of the sacrifices they make. So that if it's a conversation on that level, I think it's a lose-lose situation. So it seems to me that there's something about, in a sense, getting beyond virtue towards, it's much more like what Levi's talking about, an ethic of mutual responsibility and mutual respect. That if the conversation begins not with people getting holier than thou in relation to one another, then that opens up a space for some constructive conversations about things. And that, it seems to me, does connect with the notion of property, which is ironically much closer to the traditional conception of property in Anglo-Saxon law. The idea of exclusive ownership is actually wrong. I mean, there is no exclusive ownership of land in our traditional legal system. It's a myth that's developed since 17th century onward, reinforced by certain judicial decisions in the 19th century. But historically, as any course in property law will explain to you if you go to law school, is that property is a bundle of rights which are severable, and it carries with it responsibilities, one of which is not to create a nuisance for your neighbors. That goes back 800 years and more. in the law of nuisance. So there's a sense in which, within Western legal tradition, particularly within the Anglo-Saxon legal traditions, it's simply a matter of recovering a sense of what it is to hold property, particularly in relation to land, which is truer to a sense of a complex mutual responsibilities that need to be recognized. And I guess the final point I would make with that is that it strikes me that to the extent that people are resistant to capitalism, which is not much, it is because of a sense that capitalism overreaches, that it works by virtue of abstracting from the world and reducing everything to a cash nexus that doesn't take into account a great many other things. And so things like the witness program involve bringing people back to a recognition of the fact that they are already committed to a broader set of values and do in fact recognize that mutual responsibilities in a way that they would ignore. So that the corporate warrior is virtuous in a way that the virtuous like many warriors in the past who are good at hacking people's heads off and so forth, which takes a lot of courage, I guess, but not a very constructive way to live your life.
It's unfortunate that it's called virtue ethics because it has this connotation in our society, and you're right about the perception in our society of environmentalists and perhaps of people talking about virtue ethics, which is part of the reason it's problematic to raise it as an issue. I think there are some cultural realities about perceptions of that kind of talk that are problematic. And it reminds me actually of your comments in your one pager that the reality is that when we're participating in the broader context of political discussions around these matters, we're faced with certain realities that we didn't choose, as you say, and that perhaps we wouldn't have chosen, but nonetheless there they are. And we have to think and act strategically in that context due to those constraints. And that, I think your suggestion was that should inform this conversation from the beginning, methodologically. Which is, I think, a reality check.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess all I'm trying to add here is that in a way, as a reminder, I'm thinking about people who report the experience of working in big corporate law firms over, and there's always a guy there who's the first in the morning, right? He's there at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and he's there, he leaves at 9 in the morning. He's the wunderkind of the corporation. Why does that person have a kind of standing of virtue? Because he works hard. It's not because he makes a lot more money, but because he dedicates himself and works harder than anybody else.
If his standing is in that community, though, yeah. Lawyers, other people would think, this guy is nuts, and does he bother to get married or have a family? Because if he did, he's what a disservice he's doing to the people he's involved with.
And lacks moderation.
Lacks joy.
Okay, but what if the person is an environmentalist devoting 18 hours a day to their goals?
There are people.
And there are
know. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So I mean, I don't see any reason for denying that that's a virtue of a different kind. I mean, obviously it does have to be balanced in the life with other things and so on. And many corporate executives will see themselves as, of course, also as they're creating wealth, but they're creating wealth for all of the employees. They're they may be generous in their lives to not only their families but also to other employees. They may be giving money to charitable causes, even environmental causes. So again, if you look at it on a personal level, I see lots of virtue. I mean, I question the activity. I'm as much of an anti-capitalist as one could be, I think. But you always have to look at the goal of the activity that But if you look at it as it were on a personal level, there seems to be lots of virtue there. But then, again, that strikes me as opportunity. Okay, well now let's talk about the nature of the virtues that you display, and at what goals are they directed, or is your behavior directed, your actions directed, and maybe there's opportunity for changing those goals slightly, you know, enough to be a benefit to the environment. Rather than going in there and saying, well, you're just a capitalist pig dog, who does nothing more than acquire possessions and totally motivated by greed and so on. I mean, we're not going anywhere with that, I don't think.
I'm wondering if there's a strategic problem here, if real change is really going to happen at the level of ethics at all, or if real change is going to happen at the level of political values. We may not ever come to an agreement about a universal ethic that we can share here in Canada, but we've already come to an agreement about certain universal political values that we share, and so maybe that strategically might be the bit of ground on which to introduce environmental values rather than to worry about a universal ethic. Thinking about what George was saying this morning about healthcare. Healthcare is a universal political value in Canada, but we don't share a universal healthcare ethic in Canada. In fact, that's maybe one of the problems that the system is facing right now. So health isn't promoted as a personal ethic, even as a political value. And so, and George's example is also very well taken because it introduced the introduction of healthcare in Canada was strategically a very, is an example of an historical occasion in which there was a fundamental shift in political values that has radically altered our identity as a country and our sense of what a good human life is like. So maybe that's where the opportunity is going to arise for us. It's not so much in talking about, well, what will a universal environmental ethic look like? But maybe we should be talking more about, well, how strategically can we introduce fundamental, absolute environmental values into the political pool of what's considered to be reasonable. You know, values that we can all share no matter what our ethic happens to be. And how you achieve that is an interesting question. I'm not really sure how that's going to happen, but I think that's strategically perhaps the most likely course that our country will take in terms of introducing this.
What form do you see that in?
Well, it's both a conceptual problem and an historical problem. You know, it's clear that we already do share absolute political values. I mean, as we were mentioning this morning, a good example as a recent Supreme Court decision on security writs. If you read that Supreme Court decision, glaringly apparent is that this country is committed to procedural justice and certain rights around and freedoms, etc. It's all in it. It's all, the whole argument is built around these absolute political values. But the question I think we now face, strategically speaking, is how can we introduce environmental values, absolute environmental values, at that level of discourse so that we all see them as being reasonable, no matter what particular ethic we have.
But I'm actually not sure that we all do, even in this room, share kind of the same values.
Well, maybe not.
That's the whole point, but we have a functioning democracy that recognizes that people don't need to share the same values, but that we all have a core set of values that we consider to be politically reasonable to determine the structure of the country. Is it not possible that we could introduce into that core pool of values some fundamental political conception of environmental values? And it doesn't depend upon those values being true or God-given or sanctioned by Marx. We're just saying that these particular values are necessary for our democracy to continue to function in a sustainable manner. That's what I think is going to happen.
I think that this misses the point of all this talking, Robert, and that is that I think in morality, in ethics, you can make a distinction between values and morality. You can. In the following way, that even talking about the environmental issues, you can talk about what our environmental values are, but it's a separate question to ask then what are our responsibilities, what are our obligations, what are our duties in light of these values. And the morality, the directions, the recipes we come up for what to do need not exactly reflect these values. They better to some extent, And in fact, it may be that we can have a morality, an ethic, which accommodates quite a number of different values. We try to do this in a multicultural society. We try to have a legal system which accommodates different values. And asking about what our ethics should be is a slightly different, and maybe it's a different way of putting the same issue that Robert's putting. But we can recognize a different set of values and then ask, well, what kind of ethic do we want that will accommodate these different set of values?
Well, I think that that's, but I'm not really comfortable with that, because you could have a shared pool of political values that doesn't dictate a universal ethic. And an ethic is a personal commitment about what's right and what's true and the best way to lead our life. And we can all disagree about that. Yeah. We can all agree that in order for democracy to function, these are the reasonable values that are necessary, that open up the realm of freedom within which you can pursue your particular ethic, I can pursue mine.
But Robert, why would we want democracy to function?
Because it's a condition of our ability to pursue these values in the first place, and our own conception of the good life. So we're at a point now, I think, historically speaking, where we need to introduce fundamental environmental values into that pool, because otherwise it's just not sustainable. We're going to be in real trouble.
It's interesting that the concept of sustainability first gained our attention because of the Brundtland Commission report of the United Nations. So there was an attempt at a relatively high governmental level to insert an environmental value, and it's been relatively successful. Gradually, it's become accepted, and that's still the place you go when you, if you're doing any kind of paper on sustainability, you start with Brundtland. So, is that perhaps that's an indication of the direction to move? Maybe we. Yeah.
I'm only raising this question. Is it, you know, it's basically a strategic question. Should we be focusing on an ethic, developing a universal ethic, or what would that look like that we can all reasonably turn? Or should we be talking about this issue as a political issue, a question of political values rather than personal ethical values?
It's interesting because I think the two overlap to some extent. And yes, when I was thinking about your example of the healthcare system, I had to think about what happens to people when they sort of abdicate responsibility somewhere else. And therefore often don't feel a personal sense of responsibility to engage with those issues because they pay Medicare fees or because the government is taking care of it. Or in that sense, I could see, I mean, we might now hold in Canada universal health care to be important. It's like almost a right.
This right.
A right. Okay, for people here. And yet, the health care is a value, and yet what hasn't kind of gone along with that has been the willingness of people to act in their own lives in ways that really take care of their health in their lives and immediate surroundings, and they're looking for that to be legislated, and they're looking for that to be taken care of. So that's a little bit frightening for me, because this is not to say that healthcare is not really important. It's not a right and not all of those things. I just think that there's some way in which people aren't engaging with their own health. I'm not sure that it supports people engaging in the way that I would like to see people, let's say, engage with in their relationship with their learning world.
Let's see. It's a question of how you approach it. When healthcare was introduced as a universal value, it was introduced because it was felt at the time that healthcare was necessary to guarantee conditions for effective citizenship. You know, if I'm going to be bankrupted, I think Tom Douglas says, if I'm going to be bankrupted by a broken leg, how can I effectively function as a citizen in a democracy? And his response is, well, we need universal healthcare. And so, you know, you can imagine you could raise the same question below. How can a democracy possibly function if it's not sustainable in an environmental sense? And it's not going to. So what do we need to do to ensure that the conditions, on a political sense, the conditions for the ongoing sustainability of this democracy, how can we guarantee those things? by bringing environmental values into the basic pool. Mm-hmm. And so we're not only talking about rights and freedoms and justice, we're talking about sustainability as being a fundamental political value.
And yet, when that is the case, aren't those things open to sort of political will and changing political climates? For example, there seems to be a real desire to privatize the healthcare system or to provide some kind of public-private partnership that could be perceived as an erosion of the universal healthcare system. So, in putting it in the hands of the government, does that not mean that...
It's not in the hands of the government.
Mm,
sure. No, it's not in the hands of the government.
Or corporate interests. Or...
It's interesting, we were talking before that I kind of have the feeling that the sense of there being a value, Canadians define themselves as being people who want everybody to have health care, and Americans not. But I actually think that, in the sense, the political solution dragged along kind of that sense of identity. Canadians before 1950 didn't think of themselves that way. It wasn't something that all Canadians would rally around, universal health care. But just since it came in, and it didn't come in the States, but there are probably more Americans right now who want to have universal health care than there are Canadians with it. So what I'm saying is that if we get into a political action now, is probably, 50 years from now, Canadians might define themselves as much by their environmental ethic or values as their health values.
And I was going to pick up on that in relation to what Beth was saying, that any kind of political value like that is always contestable and it may be eroded at a certain point, but it also has history. And I was thinking of what Robert said and what you've been saying, and how Medicare didn't come all at once. There was hospital insurance before that. There was first in Saskatchewan, and later there were municipal doctors in many rural areas. There were public hospitals run by charities of one kind or another. There was a long progress towards getting towards the idea that the way to rationalize all this was through universal health insurance. Well, first universal hospital insurance and then universal medical insurance. It strikes me that there might be an analogy with regard to environmental issues, that if we think about, well, what are the kinds of environmental measures that are more or less broadly accepted in the society already? One of them is some measure of so-called wilderness preservation through national parks, provincial parks, reserves of one kind or another. There is the idea of clean water, clean air,
recycling,
which is a new idea that's become part of the package. And so maybe the way to think about concretizing what George is saying is that as a political value is to think, well, what's already there in people's commitments, more or less, that you can draw together under a larger rubric. The way the Canada Health Act kind of specifies a set of principles and says that's what we're for, these are the good principles. Maybe one can do that with regard to environmental.
Well, I think that places like, for example, the University of British Columbia undertook on a role of being a leading example in terms of, quote, sustainability. So they tangled with this off and on. I actually know this because my sister-in-law was the first director of sustainability there, and she proposed it to the university, and she got paid out of the money we actually saved by being more sustainable. Now they've far UBC and its 60 to 70,000 people has far surpassed Kyoto targets as a community of people. And one of the things they did was they sort of created this kind of set of guidelines, that kind of structure, like a little political structure in which the university acted as an entity. Mm. So that's similar, I think, as a small-scale model. It might be a small-scale model, but I think that you're talking about.
You know, it's a very sad thought, but I often think in relation to the healthcare system that it's a good thing for Canada that the US doesn't buy into that, or doesn't have that same self-image, let's say. Because it's one of the ways in which Canadians distinguish themselves and feel nationalistic and be proud of their own achievements, is by contrast with the United States. So, and I think that comes into environmental values as well. You know, we have lots of clean water, the US doesn't, we have lots of clean air, then there's Pittsburgh. of course, you find similar examples in Canada, but we don't talk about that. So that kind of, I think if the US had a universal healthcare system, it wouldn't really enter in as much into Canadian consciousness as it does at the moment. But anyway, I'm being a bit of a cynic.
Yeah, there's some ways in which the US led with the Endangered Species Act. And
I think another approach has been in Costa Rica since like the mid-80s has, you know, Costa Rica has very few resources, but they seem to have a big commitment to becoming an environmentally progressive place. And they took some of the few resources they had and they put it into elementary school education. And they made a decision in the early 80s that they would start with a kindergarten class and that then they would expand it from there. You know, they'd follow that cohort right through. So they kind of wrote off the older kids and adults as being, you know, not impressionable or educable. And in, so we're about 25 years into it. And if you talk with people in Costa Rica, you know, under the age of 25 or 30, they are remarkably articulate and kind of erudite about environmental things. There's a real difference. Now, it hasn't become a personal ethic with everybody in that, you know, the garbage outside the walls and things, but, you know, that's a country that there's kind of some basic groundwork been done there that I think is going to play out in a pretty interesting way over the next 50 years, you know, those people are starting to come into political power, you know, at all levels of government. They're doctors and lawyers, and it's pretty exciting.
I just want to make one comment about just a quick follow up on the idea of how the value of health and universal health care in a place like Canada catalyzes a hierarchical series of events that kind of ancillary benefits, and that is not just a paper value. And I come from, as I was mentioning earlier, I teach fitness, and a lot of the fitness that I teach is to seniors. And one of the things that there's an awareness in that culture there is that in order to keep healthcare sustainable, particularly with an aging population and the rising costs associated with it, is to minimize the impact on the system itself by reducing its costs through things like, I mean, I don't know what the costs are, but hip and joint replacements are very expensive things, I would imagine. And the prophylactic way of dealing with that is to build strength around those hips and joints. It doesn't deal with all the degenerative problems people have, but you can save a lot of money in the system by having that occur. So there's an increasing recognition, because we now have that, we do have that value in Canada, that those kinds of programs, you know, they occur from the political level, things like participation, which I understand is coming back now, we used to have that in Canada, are in the works. And fitness programs, for example, all over the place in various ways have been one of the benefits, I think, of universal health care. And that, I don't know if that translates into the environment, but I suspect it is. Once, for healthcare to be sustainable, these things have to happen. For the environment to be sustainable, other things have to happen analogous to that. So it's just not just a paper thing. You know, we differentiate ourselves from the American GS, but we benefit from, you know, the health office as well.
That's a question, is what kinds of programs would create the right kinds of incentives. I think the Liberal government was trying to do that with the one-ton challenge, right? Reduce your carbon emissions to one ton. That was the program killed by the Conservatives. The City of Seattle was very effective years ago with a zero garbage competition. The idea was for people to completely reduce to zero the amount of garbage that they produce through composting, recycling, and reusability. It was hugely successful in the community of Seattle. Overall, the city reduced its per capita garbage production to the best in the U.S. through this program. And there were a lot of people that were actually successful in achieving zero garbage. And of course, then they were featured in the newspaper. And how did you do it? And they would explain. And
the competitive heart.
People enjoy competition, so there's an incentive for people to participate.
I do have strong views on these issues. I am unabashedly utilitarian in my moral perspective, and that is a modified rural utilitarian perspective that looks something like Kantian ethics, that takes into account the ethics of care and virtue ethics and recognizes there's a place for all of these. But I still say that in the end, the happiness and well-being of all of us who care provides the ultimate. You can ask, why should we be virtuous? Why should we gain wealth? Well, but you don't get very far asking why we should be happy and content to be here. And I think that economic and social systems make mistakes, and the capitalist system makes a huge bloody mistake in constantly going after wealth when they should be going after happiness. When you should be asking, when the management of this province should be in terms of, what can we do so that 5 years from now, at the end of this economic plan, people are happier than they are. We should take note of why the hell it is that those UN-type studies will show that in Colombia, people are enormously happier than they are in Japan. Mm. Why? Or in Mexico. I remember a friend of mine who spent a couple of years in North Africa and came back. Her husband was doing a librarian thing there. She was doing some healthcare stuff there. I met her at an environmental ethics conference at UBC with the inauguration of the new department there. And she was, again, literally shaking her head and upset. She'd gone over to Africa to help these people. And she said, they're the happiest people I've ever spent time with. Way happier than the people here. And they're poor beyond belief. And I don't know what to do. I want to help people. But here I am in this world with all these rich people. And I don't know how to help people be happy. And I don't know how to help people be happy there because they're already happy. But I think that the utilitarian perspective clearly informs the creation of a tremendous amount of law in this country and legislation everywhere in the democratic world. People say, why should... You find this out when you get on council. I mean, why do we have these particular laws, even in this particular position? It's a pain in the ass, because in the long run, it makes us happier and better off in this community. And I think that basis provides that sort of approach. I think utilitarianism is implicit. It's in all of us in our decision making. I think making it explicit provides you with a rational basis by which to say, our political system should have these political values. We should have medical care. Why? Because most of us are happier if we do. We should have these kinds of civil rights legislation. Why? Because it will ensure that people can be happier. And what about the environment? Well, the environment counts. The environment counts because a healthy, sustainable environment with areas of pristine wilderness is one in which a community is happier and healthier.